If you want to save the world, or, dramatically shift the trajectory of global climate change, you probably picture a scientist in a lab developing some new carbon capture technology. Or
It's
maybe
like an
you're
activist, right? Organizing a massive protest.
Right, exactly. You almost certainly do not picture a mid-level commercial bank manager sitting in a glass office just staring at a spreadsheet.
No, definitely not.
But our source material today is here to completely upend that assumption. So, welcome back to the Deep Dive. It is April 27, 2026, and we are talking directly to you today about something that fundamentally shapes the physical world you live in, even if the mechanics of it are, well, mostly invisible.
Highly invisible, yeah.
We
And we're
know.
sitting right in this fascinating window of time right now.
We really are. We just wrapped up the 2025 FFD4 conference in Seville.
Advancing for Development Conference.
Yes, exactly. And now we are staring down the barrel of the upcoming 2026 UN Financing for Development Forum.
Which is arguably the most critical window for global finance in a decade. I mean, a lot of major institutional actors, from sovereign wealth funds to regional regulators, they are trying to figure out exactly how we fund the future of the planet right now, and more importantly, who is actually on the hook to do it.
Yeah. And that brings us to the source material we are pulling apart today. It's a brand new, incredibly detailed paper from the United Nations Environment Programme Finance Initiative, or UNTF.
UNPFA, yes.
The paper is titled How to Think About Banks' Contribution to Sustainability and Sustainable Development. And their core argument is that commercial banks are the absolute secret engine of the 2030 sustainability agenda.
Okay, let's unpack this.
Let's do it.
How do we actually measure a commercial bank's contribution to global sustainability when their primary product is just money?
Right.
I mean, they aren't building the solar panels, they aren't planting the forests, they are just moving digits around on screens.
Yeah.
And that tension is the entire driving force behind this paper. Because we are fast approaching the 2030 horizon for the UN's global goals, and the expectations for private finance have, well, they've never been higher.
Sure.
Governments have realized, rather starkly, I think, that they cannot fund the sustainable transition through public coffers alone. It's impossible. They need the trillions of dollars locked up in private capital markets.
But the methodology for how a commercial bank actually reports its physical impact on the world is currently in a state of confusing, almost paralyzed flux,
Oh,
right?
absolutely paralyzed.
So to understand how banks are going to fund the future, we really need to look back at the last decade and understand why the current framework is, stalling out.
Yeah.
And that starts in 2015 with the Sustainable Development Goals, the
Wow.
SDGs. I remember when the UN adopted those, suddenly every corporation on Earth, including every major bank, was slapping those colorful little square icons onto their annual
Yeah,
reports.
the little grids.
Right. There was this massive wave of private sector enthusiasm.
There was, initially. But UNEP conducted a fascinating desktop review for this new paper. They looked at 94 member banks of the Principles for Responsible Banking, the PRB, across completely different geographic regions. And they found a massive quiet pullback.
Wow, really?
Yeah. There has been a significant drop in SDG-focused reporting among these banks. Most are now just loosely mapping their existing data to the goals after the fact.
Oh, like retrofitting the data to look good.
Exactly. And only a tiny fraction actually use the SDGs as a central structuring framework for their business strategy anymore.
Reading that section of the report, I couldn't help but think about the sheer structural mismatch of it all. I mean, trying to use a massive global government policy framework for a commercial bank's daily operations seems like trying to use a manual for a spaceship to fix a bicycle.
That's a great way to put it.
It's technically comprehensive, sure, but it's totally the wrong scale. I mean, an SDG target is designed to eradicate national poverty or, protect oceans. Aren't the SDGs just too broad for a bank to realistically apply to a quarterly earnings report? Like, how is a loan officer in Ohio or Frankfurt supposed to use that?
What's fascinating here is that the UNEP 5i paper openly acknowledges that exact friction. The SDGs are fundamentally policy-focused. They were written by and for governments to achieve macro-level societal shifts.
Right.
They were never engineered for the ledger of a commercial bank. But beyond the structural mismatch, the primary driver of this pullback is something far more acute. It's legal terror.
The rise of greenhushing.
Yes, exactly. Over the last 3 to 4 years, regulatory scrutiny regarding sustainability claims has skyrocketed. If a bank claims in its public filings that it is actively advancing, say, SDG 13 for climate action, regulators and watchdog groups are no longer just nodding and smiling.
They want the receipts.
They are demanding auditable proof. And because the SDGs are so incredibly broad, I mean, SDG 13 basically just says, take urgent action to combat climate change. Proving strict, legal alignment is nearly impossible for a financial institution.
So the banks are terrified of getting sued for greenwashing.
Terrified.
They might actually be doing the hard work of financing a sustainable transition for a client, but they stay completely quiet about it. They drop the brightly colored SDG branding entirely just to avoid the liability.
Right.
But they can't just report nothing, right? The regulators still demand data.
Which is why the void left by the SDGs has been rapidly filled by an absolute alphabet soup of highly specific private sector focused frameworks.
Oh, here we go.
Yeah. We are talking about the TCFD, which is the Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosures. We have the TNFD for Nature-Related Disclosures. We have the ESRS, the Mandatory European Sustainability Reporting Standards. And, of course, the ISSB, the International Sustainability Standards Board.
I feel like we need a glossary just to get through the regulatory landscape.
You really do.
But mechanically, how are those acronyms different from the SDGs? Why do banks prefer them?
Granularity. Granularity and legal cover.
Okay.
The TCFD, for example, doesn't ask a bank to save the climate. It asks a bank to specifically disclose how a 2-degree warming scenario would financially impact their mortgage portfolio in coastal regions.
That's way more specific.
It provides standardized, hyper-specific metrics that a bank can actually measure, audit, and, you know, defend in court without feeling legally exposed.
That makes total sense. So the old government-level framework just didn't fit the realities of a commercial bank, and it carried too much legal risk.
Exactly.
So UniFi is essentially arguing that if we want to hold banks accountable, we have to stop treating them like mini-governments and start looking at their actual anatomy. We have to break down a bank's value chain to figure out where the levers of real change actually are.
Right. And to measure impact, you first have to locate it. The paper divides a commercial bank's value chain into three distinct segments: upstream, own operations, and downstream.
Okay, let's break those down. The upstream is essentially the supply chain, right?
Yeah.
The people providing the bank's IT infrastructure, the massive server farms running their high-frequency trading algorithms, the office furniture, the millions of reams of printer paper.
That is the upstream. Mm-hmm. And the sustainability impacts there are largely focused on circularity, like are they sourcing recycled materials?
Yeah.
And climate stability, which is mostly tied to the energy efficiency of those massive server farms you mentioned.
Okay, then you have the own operations. This is the physical bank itself, the corporate headquarters, the HR policies, the physical branch locations on Main Street. Mm. And I know the impact here is primarily social and governance related, touching on things like livelihood and strong institutions. Are they paying living wages? Do they have fair gender representation?
Right. And are their tax practices ethical and transparent? Do they have robust anti-money laundering protocols?
Yeah, but I am going to push back on this a bit, though. When I think of a global bank's environmental footprint, I just think of, like, leaving the lights on in the lobby or using too much printer paper. Does their upstream and own operations really matter that much on a global scale?
Well, it's not that we gloss over it, but we have to be honest about the scale. I mean, even the largest bank's physical footprint is a drop in the ocean compared to a multinational oil conglomerate or an international shipping line.
Right.
A bank's fundamental role in the global economy is as an enabler. Therefore, the vast, overwhelming bulk of their impact and the specificity of that impact lives downstream.
Downstream being their clients and customers.
Yeah.
The individuals getting mortgages, the small businesses making payroll, all the way up to the massive sovereign wealth funds and global corporations they provide credit facilities for.
That is where the power lives. The UNAPFI impact radar breaks this downstream segment into two categories, direct impacts and indirect impacts.
Direct impact is fairly obvious, I'd say. It is the impact of the financial product itself, just the act of providing the money. By simply existing and providing access to capital, banks drive what the framework calls healthy economies. If a bank abruptly cuts off lending in a specific region, that local economy suffocates almost immediately.
Almost instantly, yeah.
Plus, things like financial inclusion, bringing unbanked populations into the credit system, that is a massive, direct, positive impact. But the real friction, the truly complex part of this whole equation, is the indirect impact, isn't it?
Oh, the indirect impact is the entire ballgame. This is the impact driven by the usage of those financial products.
Okay.
Because banks lend to literally every single sector of the economy, their portfolio inevitably touches every single sustainability topic in existence. If they underwrite a bond for a mining company, their capital is directly touching biodiversity, soil health, and indigenous land rights.
And if they lend to a fast fashion brand, their money is touching labor conditions and microplastic water pollution in Southeast Asia. If they fund a solar startup, they are touching climate stability. The indirect downstream impact is essentially a mirror of the entire global economy because money is fungible, which brings up a massive logistical problem.
Oh, a huge one.
Here's where it gets really interesting. How on earth do you measure that?
It is a profound accounting challenge.
It is. If a bank's biggest impact is indirect, meaning it's entirely based on what millions of independent third-party companies do with the bank's money after the loan clears, how do they track that without going crazy?
Yeah.
Wait, I'm stuck on this idea of attribution. It's like trying to take credit or blame for a beautiful five-tier wedding cake when all you did was sell the baker the flour.
Yes.
How can a commercial bank possibly measure additionality or counterfactuals like an impact investor does? How do they know what their specific dollar achieved?
That flower analogy perfectly highlights the difference between traditional impact investing and commercial banking. In the niche world of development finance, they use a core metric called additionality.
Additionality, meaning what specific outcome was added to the world that wouldn't have happened without this exact intervention.
Exactly that. If the World Bank steps in to finance a hydroelectric dam in a rural region that previously had no power grid, they can measure the exact megawatt hours generated. They can count the exact number of homes illuminated.
Right.
They can prove the counterfactual. Without our specific loan, this specific positive impact would not exist. That is pure additionality.
But a global commercial bank cannot do that. A commercial bank is funding the corporate shell that maybe buys the concrete for the dam, but also makes payroll, buys software, and acquires a smaller competitor. The money is all mixed up.
They absolutely cannot track it that way.
Mm-hmm.
A global commercial bank's portfolio is too massive, too diverse, and too deeply interconnected to isolate that kind of one-to-one additionality for every dollar they push out the door.
Mm.
The flour company cannot track every cake. So the UNPRB framework, the Principles for Responsible Banking, introduces a new mechanism to solve this. The impact protocol dictates a two-pronged approach. Banks must use two different lenses, practice indicators and impact indicators.
Okay, let's dig into the mechanisms of those. Practice indicators. That measures what the bank actually does internally, right? It's measuring their actions, policies, and internal processes.
It focuses on how sustainability is integrated into the structural machinery of the bank. Instead of measuring the final outcome in the world, you measure the lever the bank pulled.
Give me a concrete example. How does a practice indicator actually work in the real world of, you know, high-stakes corporate lending?
A great example is examining the structural makeup of their loan agreements. A practice indicator would track the percentage of new corporate client agreements that contain strictly enforced environmental or social covenants.
Oh, so it is a contractual clause. The bank says, we will extend this $50 million credit facility, but your interest rate jumps up by 2% if you violate these specific human rights standards, or if you fail to reduce your water usage by 10%.
Yes.
But how do they actually enforce that? Do they just take the client's word for it?
In a well-structured, sustainability-linked loan, no. The covenant is tied to mandatory third-party audits. If the independent auditor finds the client missed the target, the financial penalty triggers automatically.
Wow.
So the practice indicator for the bank is simply tracking how many of those specific lever-pulling contracts they have issued. It also covers client engagement, measuring how many times the bank's advisory arm actively worked with a client to transition their supply chain or reduce waste.
That makes total sense. It is measuring the rules of the game. But a bank's internal rules don't actually tell us if the river got cleaner or if the air quality improved. How do they bridge the gap between a corporate policy and a physical outcome in the world?
That requires the second lens, impact indicators. These are significantly harder to calculate, but they are the only way to measure the aggregate footprint of the money flowing downstream.
The most famous example of an impact indicator right now is finance scope 3 emissions.
Yes.
And just to clarify how that mechanism works, instead of a bank trying to prove that a specific $50 million loan directly caused a factory to reduce its carbon output, which we establish is impossible, the bank calculates the total carbon footprint of the entire company they lent to.
Right.
And they measure the intensity of it.
Yeah.
How many tons of carbon equivalent are emitted for every single U.S. dollar the bank lends to them?
Yes, CO2 equivalent over U.S. dollars lent. That gives the bank a measurable metric of a carbon weight of their portfolio. And this applies to social metrics too. An impact indicator could be tracking the total aggregate volume of finance directed specifically toward the construction of affordable social housing within a fiscal year.
So, if a bank uses practice indicators to measure the levers they pull and impact indicators to measure the aggregate downstream footprint of their money, that sounds like an incredibly robust system.
It does.
But the UNAPFI paper points out a glaring, almost absurd flaw in how banks are currently executing this.
It is a very revealing flaw about corporate psychology, honestly. When UNAPFI reviewed that sample of 94 banks and their 2024 and 2025 sustainability reports, they found a severe misallocation of focus.
Yeah.
Banks are currently dedicating massive amounts of time, space, and graphic design in their reports to bragging about their own operations.
Because it is safe. And it is easy to measure.
It is incredibly easy. It takes very little effort to calculate the total energy consumption of your regional branch offices or track the emissions from your corporate fleet of cars.
Yeah.
It is highly auditable to report on the percentage of women in senior management or, you know, the exact number of employees who click through an online compliance training.
And to be fair, those things are objectively good. Having gender parity in management is vital. Reducing the water usage in a massive skyscraper headquarters is a net positive.
Of course.
But focusing the bulk of a sustainability report on those metrics completely obfuscates the bank's actual power. It's using highly accurate data on a tiny fraction of their footprint to distract the public and regulators from the incredibly difficult, messy work of measuring their downstream impact.
The paper is unequivocal on this point. While banks' own operations matter ethically, the true test of a commercial bank's contribution to global sustainability is entirely dependent on how it manages the billions of dollars flowing out its doors. Everything else is a rounding error.
Wow. Okay, so knowing all of this, knowing that the industry has to pivot from bragging about their lobby letting to the hard math of financed emissions we have to look forward, we are staring down this impending 2030 deadline for the Sustainable Development Goals.
We are.
What is the post-2030 blueprint? If the SDGs are too broad and legally risky, what replaces them for the banking sector?
Well, the UNEPI paper proposes a highly pragmatic path forward. They don't suggest discarding the SDGs entirely, but rather recontextualizing their role in the financial system.
Okay, how so?
The SDGs should be viewed strictly as broad impact objectives. They are the North Star. But to actually navigate toward that star, banks must rely on recognized regional sustainability taxonomies to guide their specific impact indicators.
Taxonomies, essentially highly technical, legally binding dictionaries that define exactly what counts as sustainable in a specific jurisdiction.
Exactly. The text specifically highlights frameworks like the EU taxonomy in Europe, the Green Finance Endorsed Project Catalog in China, and the Taxonomia Sustentável Brasileira in Brazil.
Let's make that concrete. Say a commercial bank in Europe is looking at a loan application for a mid-sized cement manufacturing firm. If they use the SDGs, it just says build resilient infrastructure.
Which is meaningless on a spreadsheet.
Right. But if they use the EU taxonomy, how does that physically change the underwriting process?
The EU taxonomy provides scientific quantitative thresholds. It explicitly defines the exact limit of CO2 emissions per ton of cement produced that a facility must stay under to be legally classified as a transitional activity.
Ah.
The bank takes that hard metric, inserts it into the loan covenant as a practice indicator, and measures the resulting financed emissions as an impact indicator. The taxonomy translates a broad, lofty policy goal into a rigorous, measurable financial mechanism.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, what is UNEPFI actually demanding from the United Nations as they plan for the 2026 forum and whatever framework comes next?
They lay out four specific urgent recommendations.
Okay.
First, the UN must explicitly acknowledge the private sector's role in the post-2030 agenda. The next framework cannot be written exclusively for governments.
Makes sense.
Second, the UN needs to identify priority sectors and outline expected contributions per sector. The expectations placed on a global commercial bank must be fundamentally different from the expectations placed on a massive agricultural conglomerate.
It sounds like UNOPEI is telling the UN to wake up and talk to the people actually moving the money.
Which is their third point. In defining these new rules, the UN must engage actual banking practitioners in the drafting process. You cannot have policy wonks in Geneva dictating financial metrics that cannot physically be integrated into a banking ledger.
Right. You need the people who actually know how the spaceship operates to write the manual.
Exactly.
What's the final recommendation?
Finally, They recommend leveraging that alphabet soup of emerging standards we discussed, the ISSB and the ESRS, to make them entirely interoperable. Right now, global banks are facing a fragmented compliance nightmare. The UN's goal should be to foster a cohesive global ecosystem of data so that a metric measured in Brazil translates seamlessly to a ledger in London.
So what does this all mean? When you zoom out, this entire UNOP55 paper is essentially a roadmap for a massive, painful, but necessary maturation process in the financial sector.
Yeah, maturation is the right word.
It means we are finally moving away from the era of broad, feel-good government goals, where a bank just slaps a colorful SDG sticker on a marketing brochure and calls it a day. We are moving toward granular, sector-specific banking rules based on rigorous regional taxonomies, hard data, and legal accountability.
We are witnessing the end of public relations sustainability and the beginning of operational integration. It is a wildly complex transition, but it is the only viable path if capital markets are going to align with planetary boundaries.
We've covered a tremendous amount of ground today. We've seen how banks initially embraced the broad SDGs, but then rapidly backed away as legal scrutiny and the fear of greenwashing took hold. We realized that their true power isn't in how much printer paper they recycle in their own operations, but in their massive downstream role as the financial enabler of the entire global economy. And we explored the mechanical reality of how they are adopting a two-prong approach, measuring internal practice indicators and external impact indicators to finally track the invisible footprint of their capital.
And yet, there is one critical piece of this puzzle we haven't touched on.
Which is exactly where I want to end today. Before we wrap up, there is one final, mind-bending concept from the source text that completely shifts how we view risk itself. I want you to leave the listener with the concept of dynamic materiality.
Dynamic materiality. This is the concept that forces banks to care, even if they have zero ethical interest in saving the planet.
Yeah.
Historically, traditional banks have only cared about a sustainability issue if it represents a direct, immediate financial risk to their bottom line.
Right. If a factory they lent money to is illegally dumping toxic chemicals into a local river, but the factory is highly profitable and making its loan payments on time every month, the bank historically hasn't viewed that pollution as a material financial risk.
Exactly.
It is bad for the world, but it doesn't show up on the bank's balance sheet.
But the UNPFI paper highlights that materiality is dynamic. It is not a static state. An environmental or social impact that doesn't cost a bank a single dime today can transform into a massive, portfolio-crushing financial risk literally overnight.
Walk me through how that happens. Give me a scenario.
Okay, let's use your factory example. Year one, the factory pollutes the river, the bank collects interest. Year three, local communities start protesting. It is a PR headache, but still not a financial risk for the bank.
Right.
Year four, a sudden sweeping EU water directive is passed. Overnight, that factory is hit with a 100 million euro fine and forced to halt operations until they install new, vastly expensive filtration systems. The factory's cash flow evaporates. They default on their loan.
Oh, well.
Suddenly, the bank is holding a stranded asset and taking a massive write-down.
Okay.
The transition from a non-financial ethical issue to a hard credit default happened in an instant.
The legal landscape shifted beneath their feet. Or it could be physical risk, too. Like, the river they rely on for cooling just dries up due to climate change, and production stops entirely.
Precisely. That is dynamic materiality. Ignoring downstream sustainability isn't just bad for the planet anymore. It is fundamentally bad risk management. To protect their own massive portfolios, banks must holistically understand the real-world impacts they are enabling downstream, because tomorrow's environmental crisis is today's hidden financial risk.
That is a wildly powerful place to leave it. It removes the ethics entirely and makes it about pure financial survival. Next time you interact with your bank, whether you are logging into an app on your phone, reading an interest rate on a screen, or walking past a physical branch on the street, I invite you to look at them differently. Don't just see a sterile vault holding your money. Think about the flower and the cake. See them as a vast, powerful enabler, actively shaping the global environment, the climate, and the economy through every single loan covenant they sign. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. We'll catch you next time.